Thank you, John, for sharing us. And our group has asked Jack to share a story with us tonight.
My name is Jack Mullins. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jack.
My sobriety date is September 17th, 1986. I am sponsored and I sponsor. And my sponsees have sponsees. So I think that's the way the deal is supposed to go down, the way I read the big book. I got sober at 19. I guess some people call it a one-chip wonder. I just took the stuff seriously when I got here. My experience of picking up that white chip took a few days, though. I'm not sure about the rest of you guys. Because when I got here, I knew some guys that were in AA. I knew family members that were in AA. And I knew I was not like them. Because those guys were grumpy. They were old. They had all sorts of issues. But I had nothing in common with those guys. I was 19. My life was ahead of me. All I had was a few simple problems. And once I got that managed out, everything would be okay. Right? And it's been a whirlwind since that day. Because they drug me to an AA meeting. I didn't know I was getting an intervention that day. And my eyes slowly opened up because I heard people like you guys share your stories. And I had nothing but resentment for those first few days of meetings. You know, it's like, I'm not like these guys. And I don't know, maybe if I'd sobered up in YPG, I might have had a different experience, but I was not sitting in a room with my peers. It was a bunch of gray-haired old people sitting there telling me about everything they'd lost in life, and I had nothing, you know, to lose. I mean, I was just like, you know, I don't know what your guys' problem is, you know. You guys have been in and out of marriages. You got kid problems. You got wife problems. You got ex-wife problems. I don't have any of those problems. Those aren't my issue, you know. They had countless DUIs. I hadn't been cuffed and stuffed officially. I came very close, but I did not get officially cuffed and stuff. I was asked nicely to sit in the back of a cop car while they were getting ready to cuff and stuff me. And then there was a domestic violence charge, and they had to leave me alone, and I was supposed to turn myself in my own recognizance, and I ended up with a bench warrant because I didn't do that either, all over a fake ID. But that's a good story. I mean, how does one become an alcoholic? I don't know. You know, I've read a lot and stuff in my years of sobriety. I think family has a lot to do with it. The nut does not fall far from the tree in my observation. But I'm the only one out of six kids that showed up here, and we all grew up in the same crazy alcoholic lifestyle. My grandfather was an alcoholic. I got a picture of my dad in high school, studying a book of alcoholism, writing his thesis on the ways and worries of an alcoholic lifestyle, and didn't save him. I had a perfect example in front of me, didn't save me. What I've come to understand as I go back and I look at my time in drinking and a much longer time in sobriety, so my absolute unmanageability insanity only lasted about a year and a half, 2 years. I started drinking, though, at six. And the problem that showed up shortly after is my dad got sober by the time I was 11. And so I had a very short amount of drinking in those early years where I had access. But when I did, I did it a lot. I became, at 6 years old, a fan of something called Cold Duck. I don't even know if they sell it, but somewhere between grape, knee-high, and champagne. But it goes down easy when you're six. And the thing that I know about it is because when I would drink it, it tasted kind of good. But it had that bubbly, weird thing. And then about an hour later, it was a great idea to, like, jump off of barn roofs or to go flying off of a horse, you know, 20 miles an hour or whatever. I mean, it would just, whatever stupid thing that came up that I would never do sober, and of course you don't use words like sober at six, but things you would never do unless you were drinking became a good idea. And I became the life of the neighborhood. At an early age, because I would go get drunk behind the barn and then go get all the neighborhood kids and we'd do something crazy. And I would normally be the ringleader of it. Eventually that kind of waned off and access to booze was not an option. But I did progress in my drinking away from Cold Duck and got up to bourbon I can't remember the fancy name, but it's vodka with grapefruit juice. and we would drink that. And I loved doing that. I loved being the bartender at my dad's parties, because that was, you know, you're 10, 11, you're mixing the drinks, and you're pouring one for them, and one for you, and one for them, and then clean up the dirty drinks, drink that, and then pour them a fresh one, and I'd get pretty ripped. And nobody seemed to care, because everyone else was, that was keeping count at that time. But then that period of time went where roughly about 9 years went, and there was no alcohol in the house. And that was a miserable period of my life, because there's just no way to get rid of the thing that I wake up with, you know. And to this day, I can wake up restless, irritable, discontent. Having done the steps once does not mean you're forever changed. You can wake up restless, irritable, and discontent. That's been my experience, the experience of most of the people that I hang with, is you can get in a bad place, even in sobriety. The question is do you go back and drink over it? And for the crew that I run with, we don't go back and drink over that stuff. We find that the steps is a much better solution for restless, irritable, and discontent upon awakening. Pages 86 or 87 give some good ideas as well on what to do. But that's where I was. And so for the next several years of my life, only thing I wanted to be was anywhere but where I was. That included daydreaming, physical, getting out of where I was, run away from home, come up with the most convoluted stories in middle school and high school about where I was. This was before cell phones, pagers, trackers, GPS. And you could convince everybody that you were somewhere else and just disappear for a day or two. And I would do that. And once I got to the point where I had a car and could travel on my own, alcohol immediately entered my life. Because with a car, you could make anything possible. You could find somebody with an ID and money and drive them somewhere, because not everybody had a car. And alcohol was immediately the number one thing in my life, right? I was going through school, a straight A student in grade school, get to high school, straight A's first semester, B's, C's second semester, and failed out by the end of the freshman year, because I immediately started drinking as soon as I had access to a car. That was the goal. That was the objective. How quick could we go off and get on a bender and then plan it to last all weekend? Because I wake up feeling horrible. I wake up full of all these fears. And I don't think of them as fears. You don't do an inventory in middle school and high school. You don't think about this stuff. You just know that something's not right in life. And that's the way I would wake up. And I knew the only sense of ease and comfort I would get would start that weekend. And so I became a weekend binger. Freshman year of high school. Sophomore year, exact same thing, except we skipped with the A's and B's, went straight for the C's first quarter, and from there just fell apart and essentially flunked out of high school the second year. D's and F's. And it's not because I'm not a good student or any of that stuff. It's simply because I'm a reckless alcoholic, and the thing that matters most to me is being out of my mind. Not doing anything else that actually matters or counts towards life or would actually help me achieve some life goal or dream or ambition that I have, but escaping from reality was my number one feat. And I became quite good at it over that year. Third year, they did not invite me back to high school. They'd noticed a pattern, and my parents couldn't figure out what the heck was going on, because they'd send me to summer school when I'd ace summer school, and everyone's like, we don't understand. The kid just doesn't do it. He just won't do homework. He won't do anything. So I ended up graduating my third year, went to this school where apparently if you paid him enough money, they would give you all the credits you needed to graduate. And so I felt victorious. I had emerged with a high school degree in my third year, which basically led to more binging, except you didn't have to wait for the weekend. You could binge every day. And I was attending college, but I never sat in the classroom. I would register, get my books, show my parents all this stuff, and then never show up for class. And then withdraw and say, oh, didn't work out. We'll do it again next semester. This went on, and this is where all the insanity started to mount up in my life. You know, problems with women, problems with landlords, problems with utility companies, problem with friends, problems with roommates and people whose couches I would crash on and create all the devastation that we do in our drinking days. It just got really bad. It got to the point where family kicked me out. So I thought, hey, what a great idea. I got an inspired moment here. I'm going to move in with my brother. He likes to party. I know he does, because I've seen him party, and I know where he keeps his party supplies. And so I moved in with him, and after about 4 weeks, he asked me to move out because he saw the way I partied and said, you're going to end up in big trouble, and I don't want any part of that. And so I was out on my own and sleeping on couches again, and worked my way into another roommate situation. Again, this whole time telling everybody I'm active in school, and I've still never sat in a classroom. But that's the story that seems to keep everyone off my back about why I'm unemployable. And I've got this multi-level marketing scam where I'm selling non-conference approved goods and services to people who are actually in college, and I would just drive from college to college with my multi-level marketing scam. And that would pay for my gas and keep me happy and inebriated. But I knew this was going to end up in a bad way, because if I ever got caught, and I'd been pulled over a dozen times, and if anyone had searched the vehicle, I wouldn't be looking at sunshine today. But that never happened. I can't explain why. And I ended up sitting in my apartment on or about the middle of September, about the 15th, I would argue, and trying to explain to my parents how I'm going to make it through school. And I found out that the president of the SAE fraternity lived two apartment doors down from me. At this point, I've ascended in my career to working as an assistant liquor manager. There's typically two people in a liquor store, the manager and the assistant liquor manager, and nobody else. So it's a big title. Head job is dusting the bottles. And this was before scanners, so you had to go click, click, click and put the labels on. And it was glorified stockman and duster, but it's assistant liquor managers on the resume. And the deal with that is I'm not legal to drink, because I sobered up at 19 and was unfavorable, because the year I turned 18 is the year that they changed it to 21. So half of the people born in 66 could drink at 18, and I was in the second half that was not allowed to. But so I'm stealing booze illegally. I can sell it, I just can't drink it. So I figured that was an injustice that I could resolve myself by just putting it in the bag, ringing someone else up for the same thing, and it all worked out. And then what would happen is I get to the end of the week and I wouldn't have enough money in my paycheck to pay for the rent and the booze, so I just start taking the booze, saying I'll pay for it out of next week's. And then pretty soon I just wouldn't even pay the rent, and all I was doing was paying the back payments on all the booze I was stealing. And so it caught up with me. And this fraternity brother goes, you know, the way this thing works is we have all the exams, we have all the papers. All you got to do is join the fraternity and you're in. Turn in the stuff that we've already got and it'll be great. So I'm like, great, finally going to get a college degree. By the way, I'm in the liquor business and not sure if that would be helpful. So they wanted me to sell them booze at deep discounts, and I was willing to make that arrangement for them in return for a college degree, because I had all this figured out in the first 2 weeks of school. And I went in to get said liquor after hours, and the door alarm goes off. You know, it's not like it calls the cops. It just goes ding, 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 ding. So the guy dusting the shelf knows that someone came into the liquor store. Well, someone on the other side of the wall heard the door go off as I went in and threw a couple bottles into a bag, locked the door on my way out, and jumped into a car and took off. And so by the time I got home, the only other person with a key to the liquor store had already answered their phone, and they knew who was at the liquor store, and the jig was up. That was my last night of drinking. I was already ripped by the time I got there, because that's when I do my best thinking, as always, and decided that opening the liquor store after hours was the great way to finish a college career or start a college career, however you like to think of it. I like to think of the conclusion, not the work in between. And I got busted. I was asked to show up the next day, and I was promptly fired and asked to turn in my key and never set foot in the property again for stealing. And I went home and I wanted to die, because I had this family member who's in AA. They have friends who are in AA. In the back of my mind, I knew this was bad news, because how do you explain stealing liquor if you're not an alcoholic? But my mind wouldn't even say what I just said out loud. I just knew I was in trouble. And I locked myself in a room for 3 days, and I didn't want to live, and I didn't want to die. I didn't want to be awake. I just wanted to be in the blackness, just anywhere but here. And I'm sure I came out of that bedroom to use the restroom or something, but I honestly have no recollection of that week or since then. But I know what it was like, not wanting to live and not wanting to die for days. I got a phone call. out Monday morning. This happened on a Thursday. Monday morning, I get a phone call from a family member asking if I had class that morning. I said, no, my classes are Tuesday, which I had no idea because I hadn't been to class. But I was free on Monday. And so they took me out. We ate breakfast. And we went to see this other guy for a few minutes. And then I was going to get a ride to back to my place. And what ended up happening was the person who took me out to breakfast dropped me off at this other guy's house and left me. And what started was a 12-step or an intervention. I didn't know it. I didn't get the invite. I was a captive passenger in a car, and someone promised to give me a ride home. And what I saw instead was a big pot of coffee and some muffins. And we sat and we talked. We ate some muffins. We talked some more. That guy told me about his drinking career, because he started drinking as a teenager and started drinking in college and it screwed up his college career, and he decided that what he really needed was money, not an education, and he'd moved to the islands and was making 200-300 bills a night and woke up broke every morning because he was partying, and I could identify with that. That had happened every time I started. Every time I did whatever I had to do to make a couple hundred bills, I woke up broke the next morning because I'd partied it all away. So I could identify with the guy. I had a lot in common. He started talking about, you know, what life was like in the islands and all the fun times, waking up on the beach and sailing and drinking and this and that. And I'm like, man, that's a lifestyle. I could identify with this, you know, carefree lifestyle, no worries. Started talking about the other things that happened, and I didn't recognize those things. He started talking about being homeless and sleeping in the ditch, waking up in the gutter behind the bar. And I had not had that, and I'm like, man, this guy's got problems. And then he started talking about, you know, waking up in a flop house and not knowing who had pissed the bed, him or the woman next to him. I'm like, I don't ever have that problem. Then he started talking about other things that go on in the depravity of alcoholism and losing control of your bowels and everything else, and I have never had that happen to me. And I'm like, man, this guy, it's a good thing he's not drinking. But I wasn't willing to admit to alcoholism. But I could identify with the first part of his story. But I did not have what he had because I could clearly stop. After all, I'd theoretically stopped for the last couple of days. So he asked me about mine. And I'm, you know, how many times do you drink? And I'm like, well, and I'm counting the number of blackouts I can remember. And I'm like, it's less than 10 blackouts. You know, and I don't know what a blackout is. I'm just counting the 10 because I figure what the experience of a blackout was meant that you were drunk. The rest of the days didn't count. He's like, all right. So we end up at a couple AA meetings, and I kind of get the idea of what's happening at this point. And I'm not picking up a white chip, and I'm not shaking hands with anybody. I'm just looking to get out. And he takes me back to my apartment, and there's that pregnant moment of silence. I don't know if any of you guys sponsor people and you got that new guy in the car and the guy's not made the decision. You're sitting there waiting for him to say something and you're going, do I say something? Do they say something? That moment just seemed like forever. And he's just sitting there and I'm looking at my room and I can see in my apartment that I share with three of us, that there's a party going on, people coming and going. There was always a party because I always had liquor and other stuff. And he goes, if you go up there, are you going to drink her drug tonight? I said, I don't know. He says, is that what you want to do? And I said, I don't know. And that was the first two honest things I had honestly said that whole day. I don't know. And he made me an offer I couldn't refuse. He said, why don't you go grab your toothbrush, a couple pairs of underwear, short and shirt, whatever you need, and you can sleep on my couch for a couple days till you figure out what you want to do. So I said, okay. Walked right through the middle of a party in full bore, grabbed underwear, socks, shoes, shirt, put together a little go bag. Got in his car, and I had no idea what was going to happen, but I slept on his couch. What ended up happening was I got drove to a 6:30 in the morning meeting, a noon meeting, a 5:30 meeting, a 6:45 meeting or something like that, an 8:15. We went to a 10:30, and we managed to get a midnight in that day. And then we went to sleep and we started it all over again the next morning. It's with a 6:30 meeting. And that went on for a couple days. And I refused to pick up a white chip because everybody in every meeting we went to, everybody was an old person with all these crazy life problems. And none of them had the issues that I did. No one could identify with the problems that I have at 19. And It's about the third day. It was Thursday. And this whole adventure started on Tuesday. And they take me to a meeting. And I'm sitting there going, good God, not another meeting. But I don't have another option. I don't know what I want to do. You know, at this point, I'm willing to admit that the unmanageability of my life with my multi-level marketing business is going to land me in jail. And that clearly is not a life objective. And that's got to stop. I got to pay back a bunch of people that don't show up on your credit reports, or they're going to break my legs. I've got a whole bunch of other problems, but alcohol is not one of them. But I got to go to a 5:45 meeting at the club. And again, all these old timers, and I swear they're all looking at me and telling me how to do it and what I need to do and all these problems. I'm like, I've got nothing like these guys. And I have nothing but resentment and contempt in my heart for all these people talking at me, because I do not have their problems. I'm 19, and there isn't anybody in that room that doesn't look like they're 70. And I get up, and my hand hits the door. They're saying the Our Father. I don't even want to say the Our Father. I'm a quasi-religious guy. I go to church on Sunday, but I'm drunk Sunday night, and I'm drunk Saturday morning, Sunday night. And I'm just don't want to do this, and I just nothing's feeling right. And I walk to the door. My hand hits the door, the 5:45, and it's like that. I've had my first spiritual experience. And I'll describe it to you, but it won't mean much to you, but it'll give me goosebumps, because my life changed that moment. And I'm not a poet, and I don't study poetry, but there's a poem, I want to say by Robert Frost, that goes something about the path less taken or the road less traveled or something like that. There's a book and a poem. The poem is what came to mind. And the author writes about how he's standing on a path or a road, and he's looking down that road, and he can see the wheel ruts, and they go up and down over the hills and over the valleys. And he's pretty sure that if he gets on this road and he keeps walking, even though he can't see the full path, that he's going to end up in the city in the distance, because that road looks like it's going to end up in that city. And he looks to the side and sees a path into the woods, and he has no idea where that path goes, but it's less traveled. It's barely even a path, but he can tell that it's a path and it goes into these woods, and he has no idea where it's going to take him. But he's pretty sure if he stays on this road and goes over these hills, he's going to end up in that city, or he could take this path less traveled. And in an instant, I knew that poem meant to me that I was an alcoholic. And I was bawling. I went outside, picked up the phone, called that family member who dropped me off 4 days earlier. I'm an alcoholic. Okay. Click. There was no parade. Told the guy I'd been sleeping on his couch, I was an alcoholic. But what I knew in that moment was I drink for the same reason every alcoholic drinks. I drink for the effect. I drink to get buzzed. I drink to escape. I drink to be anywhere but where I'm at that very moment. Because life is unmanageable. And I'm absolutely insane without a spiritual program of action. And nobody knows that when you show up. I haven't met a single guy that I've ever talked to that understood that stuff. It's not until I realized that I drink for the same reason every other alcoholic drinks, and that this is a chronic, fatal, progressive disease, and the only difference between me and the 60-year-old or 70-year-old in the room telling me all their tales of woe is whether or not I'm willing to get off at this floor of the elevator. I can go all the way to the end, and so many of us do. And my poor candy ass couldn't take 3 days without a drink or a drug. I didn't want to live, and I didn't want to die. I just didn't want to wake up. I didn't want to feel anymore. It was too much. And these guys had something I didn't have. They went to Joffrey Coffee House and had a good time. They'd laugh about the stuff that I thought was absolutely humiliating. They'd laugh about stuff that I couldn't even dream how bad you had to be to get to that point, because I couldn't take it where I was at that point. So I was willing to go to any length, as they say. I was a little scared, because anybody I knew that did the stuff that was written on that wall turned into an asshole. And I didn't want any part of that. And if you really did the stuff that this God stuff's talking about, the guys that I knew that did God stuff ended up dressing in black and feeding poor and starving kids all around the world. Because if you do that God stuff for real, you got to go do that stuff, right? And I'm like, oh man, I want to get married. I got plans. I got all sorts of stuff. And I'm not ready to go feed starving kids somewhere else. But thank God, I wouldn't be here today if I didn't have a step Nazi for a sponsor who insisted that the steps were the only solution, or I was going to die a pitiful alcoholic death. That I'd already turned into one. There was no hope. It was futile. The only thing I had to do was pick up the kit of spiritual tools laid at my feet, as it talks about on page 25 of the big book. This is all we have. We have a kit of spiritual tools. If we do these steps, we can change our life in a way that nobody could possibly imagine. I did the steps in about 10 days. I did my fourth step before that Saturday. We did 1, 2, 3 on my knees Thursday night. I got a lot of instructions on Friday on what a four-step looked like. I got more instructions Friday at noon on what a four-step looked like. I got more instructions Friday evening on what a four-step looked like. Because my initial four-step basically said I was afraid of spiders and snakes and alligators, because I would literally wake up with nightmares. We grew up in a rural area of Florida, and all those things were around, and they give you nightmares. I found out later that my life is riddled with fear. It's the very fabric of my being, and that's why I wake up restless, irritable, and discontent. That I'm more preoccupied with what you guys think about me than actually doing anything or considering what I'm doing to myself. I realize that fear not only is equated with stealing, it's the very means by which I'd lived my whole life up to that point. I'd never consciously tried to make contact with myself, let alone a higher power, to make a decision that was based off of what we call, facts, That four-step process showed me in a gross sort of way how much my life was made up of decisions based off of fear, how I make decisions based off of selfishness, although I really think I'm trying to be helpful to the rest of you because you're misguided. And if you would just do it the way I see it, it would all work out a lot better for all of us. But I could see where it was me. Every decision that I had made was the thing that had brought my life to this point where alcoholism had become my master and I had no choice out. I did the fifth step, which according to my sponsor and the guys who sponsored him is not going over your four step, but actually going through all the stuff that was never in your four step and telling your complete life story. And all the stuff that I was too embarrassed, too afraid, too unwilling to admit to came out. The stuff that I had not thought of in years. The stuff I've never told another person but my sponsor on that one night I talked about. And I bawled my eyes out. And we asked when we were all done. I said, yeah. Are you sure you've got it all done? Because the next page says if you've cut back and held back on anything, this could erode the foundation of your sobriety. And I sat as a sniveling mess because I was holding on to something I would never tell anybody. And he asked again, and I couldn't look him in the eye, and I wanted to die. And I felt exactly like I did 3 days or a week earlier for 3 days. I finally told him what it was. And he didn't admit that he had done it or he knew somebody else who had done it. He just said, okay, why don't we ask God for forgiveness? And move on. And it was gone. It was gone that easily. It's not that I don't have regrets about it, but I don't have to drink over it. And I knew it right then and there. It was gone. 6 and 7 is pretty easy because we had done a fourth step, and my fifth step in Revelations showed that I had the same pattern of shortcomings were kicking my butt. So I had something to pray about every night. I still pray to ask God to remove those defects of character because they haven't gone in 30 years of sobriety. They're not as gross as they used to be. I'm a little bit more spiritually aware of when I'm engaged in. I don't have to wait 3 years or 5 years or 20 minutes before I realize I'm messing up and I'm engaging in my shortcomings, so I can make amends a little bit quicker and stop at least the engagement of those shortcomings. Don't have to make my life as much of a mess as I once did. 8 and 9, again, pretty straightforward. If you've just done your fourth and fifth, you've definitely gone through a list of people you probably owe an amends to. The biggest thing about amends that I learned at that time was amends isn't saying sorry. Amends is making right a situation that you made wrong based off your poor choices. In some of those cases, my amends is never to talk to that person again because they are so upset with me that any thought of me in their life brings them to pain. There's still one female that I owe an amends to, if you want to think of it as a I'm sorry or going back to, but I believe that I've crossed that road because after the second attempt to make the amends, first was in person, second was a letter years later, that came back, do not return or do not respond. I've never done the behaviors that I did with that girl with any other woman, and that's the best I can do. I pray for her that God would give her everything that she would want in life. Other people I had to pay back. Those people who do not show up on your credit report but are very insistent on being paid back, I paid back 100%. Because the best thing I could do as a living amends is not have them involved in my life. And as soon as they were paid, they were more than glad to be out of my life. The amends I owed my family was to be a brother, to be a son. And I spent years doing that. 10, 11, and 12 for me are the basis. And the guys that I was sponsored by had been under the influence of Clarence Snyder. He was in the first three editions of our big book under the Boilermaker story. And Clarence was a big believer that once you did 1 through 9, that you could stay sober for the rest of your life on 10, 11, and 12. And I saw Clarence Snyder my first 90 days sober. I'll be honest, I don't remember a lot about it except for the fact that I saw Clarence Snyder. And I was standing in the very back of Sobriety, which was a very small room at that time. And I knew to make a note that I saw Clarence Snyder, his stories in the big book. But what I do believe, and you can hear Clarence Snyder tapes or MP3s, as you will, is he stresses the importance that if you've done 1 through 9 well, 10, 11, and 12 can keep you sober. But you got to do them every day. And I do, to the best of my ability. And that ability is not a flat line. It goes up and down, for the record. Some days I'm more able than others. But as I went into 10, 11, 12, what I found in all my sobriety is the importance of doing them every day is that I can't do a 12 unless I've really done 10 and 11. And I can't do 11 at all in any effective measure if I don't truly understand that my dependence on God is evidenced in my 10-step inventory. Because if I do it every day, what I realize is while I have made some progress over the years, that those same shortcomings still play a role in my life. I still owe people amends for being not so kind of a boss, not so nice of a sibling, not so nice of a husband. Being motivated by selfishness or fear, I will engage in my favorite shortcomings because I feel that they're empowering me at the time and that I'm going to manage better by engaging in them. But that's never the case. I recognize that I don't have this thing licked and all I have is a spiritual reprieve if I will do my 11th step and make that the basis of my 11th step, because I've also learned that my higher power is not Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy or anything else. It's not going to sprinkle good blessings in my life just randomly for the sake of it happening or because I wanted it. What I understand the role of the higher power in my life is that it helps me accomplish that which I cannot do by myself. And the Serenity Prayer is so integral to my life. I do the third step prayer, the seventh step, but the Serenity Prayer and make it a living part of my daily interactions is critical because I have to realize the things that I can do, and I don't believe God's a labor-saving device. I have to realize the things that I can't do, and what's most critical is the wisdom to understand the two. Because the things that I can't do, I want to grab my shortcomings and go make that a reality. And that never works out well for me or anybody around me. The things I can do, I can be a better boss. I can be a better coworker. I can be a better spouse. I can be a better sibling. I can be a better son. There are small things I can do each day to do each one of those better. I'm physically capable of it, and I have the lips and the mental ability to apply some of that. So long as I'm divorced of self-will. So long as I'm divorced of self-seeking measures, in those actions, I can make the world a better place for the people that I work with. But I have to be in that place of centered, and I can't get there by myself. The thing that gets me to that spot is recognizing the chaos I can bring into the lives of the people around me, and that my dependence has to be on God to bring about a change that I can't make. It's not a self-help program. It's a God dependency program, is what I've learned. And I have to be dependent on God in that moment. At that moment, it changes the dynamic by which I enter that prayer time with my higher power. I'm not begging on my knees. I'm consoled by a friend who's as real to me as my spouse. I know it's real because I would not be sober 30 years later if something had not happened at a 5:45 meeting with a bunch of old timers. I know it's real. I see young people get sober. I see chronic relapsers get sober if they're willing to do the stuff that I was told to do. I was desperate enough to do it. When you get the opportunity to do a 12-step, whether it's with somebody in AA or practicing these principles in all your affairs, and you start by your 10-step inventory to realize things that you were never capable of doing are happening in your life, you have to believe in the power of your higher power to work in your life. At least cooperate with that higher power to bring about a change in your life. And that's what's happened to me. I remember being that first couple days, and my sponsor asked me, you know, what did I want out of life, and, you know, a bunch of these eternal questions, and I gave him a bunch of stupid answers that a barely sober 19-year-old would do. My life today, I've done things beyond my wildest fascinations or imaginations as a kid. I wanted to see the world. I've seen the world. I've flown around the world. I've worked in 20 or 30 countries. I've been a big corporate speaker. I've spoken at international conferences. I've had books and papers and press written about the ideas that I've come up with in business, not because I'm gifted, but because I apply the spiritual principles I learned in AA in my work environment. Because I learned how to go to school and be a student. Because everything that I could not do in a place of untreated alcoholism, I learned how to do by practicing these principles. It's changed my life. I live a life that's unimaginable, and I'm grateful every day. And none of it would have been possible if it wasn't for one alcoholic reaching out to another 30 years ago in my life and carrying a message that I didn't want to hear and driving me to a bunch of meetings I didn't want to go to until I was willing to recognize the gift that somebody was offering. And like Dr. Bob says, for that I'm eternally grateful, and it's the reason why I continue in AA today. Thank you.